This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. In a special message to Congress in March of 1964, President Lyndon Johnson launched the War on Poverty. He called it a milestone in the 180-year search for a better life for our people. President Johnson created a Job Corps, a work training program, a work study program. Within a year, he also signed into law Medicare and Medicaid, which provided health care for the elderly and the poor. Now, 40 years later, most everyone would agree that poverty has, at the very least, changed in the U.S. Only the poorest in North Carolina struggle to put food on the table and can't find any job that would provide an income. But a higher percentage can be classified as working poor, that is, those who work full-time or more, holding more than one job, and still cannot make ends meet. As part of our series, North Carolina Voices, Understanding Poverty, we begin today at taking a look at how poverty is defined in our country, how we classify those who are poor, and how poverty has changed since Lyndon Johnson fired the first shot in the War on Poverty 40 years ago. We welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. What is poverty? Is the state of poverty in this country improving or getting worse? Again, our number is 1-877-962-9862. We are joined this hour by Robert Rector, who is a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He joins us from the Heritage Foundation in Washington. Welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you for having me here.
And Mark Greenberg is with us. He is Director of Policy for the Center for Law and Social Policy, and he is with us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Hi there, Mark Greenberg.
Hi, thanks very much.
Well, I would like to start our conversation by asking the question, what is poverty? But we probably need to start with something a little less broad. So, Mark Greenberg, let's start with you. How has poverty changed since President Johnson declared that war on poverty 40 years ago?
Well, probably the most dramatic change over this period of time has been a significant improvement in poverty among the elderly. The elderly are much less likely to be poor now than they were 40 years ago. On the other hand, for children, they are just about as likely to be poor now as they were 40 years ago. So the poor are now much more likely to be children than they were back then.
Mm-hmm. And so what is the percentage of children that we consider to be living in poverty now?
Sure. In the official poverty statistics, which I know we're going to be talking about as we go, but in the official poverty statistics in 2003, 17.6% of children were poor. By way of contrast, if one looks at working age adults, 18 to 64, the figure was 10.8%. For the elderly, 10.2%. So basically 10 to 11% for those who are not children and close to 18% for children.
Mm-hmm. And we should say from the outset that as recently as 2003, the national poverty rate was about 12.5% of Americans, or just under 36 million Americans.
That's right. Basically, one in eight people.
Right. Well, Robert Rector, what's your take on this? How has poverty changed since in the past 40 years since Lyndon Johnson declared that war on poverty?
Well, I would say it's changed pretty dramatically because most of the people that we currently define as poor aren't poor and would not even remotely have been regarded as poor in 1964. Let's just start out with some very basic fact that among those individuals that are classified by the government as poor, close to two-thirds of them have a satellite or cable television, and about three-quarters of them have air conditioning. In 1964, virtually no one in the United States had air conditioning. And I think that the average citizen, when they hear the word poverty, they're thinking about someone who has inadequate housing, it's dilapidated housing, doesn't have clothes for their kids, doesn't have food to put on the table to feed their families. But if you ask poor people the simple question, did you often in the last year not have enough food to feed your family? Only 2% of the people that the government defines as poor say, yeah, we often lacked enough food. And only 1 in 10 say we sometimes lacked enough food. The principal problem relating to nutrition among poor people today is not a lack of food, but that they eat too much and have a disproportionate tendency to be overweight. Overall, when we look at the poor people in the United States, they have The typical poor person has a car, air conditioning, a refrigerator, stove, clothes washer, dryer, microwave. This individual has two color televisions, a satellite or cable TV, a VCR or a DVD, a stereo. If you ask this individual, were you able to obtain medical care for your family during the past year, he says yes. His home is in apartment or house is in good repair. It's
now,
not overcrowded.
And getting the healthcare,
these are all
of course,
government.
Right, healthcare, of course, is a huge issue, and is part of that what you're saying that those folks who would be asked if they could get healthcare, would that be because they were eligible for federal programs such as Medicare or Medicaid?
In part, and we spend an awful lot of money on the poor, which is why you have seen very large and substantial improvements in living conditions that aren't really captured in the official measures. If you ask again this individual, the typical poor person, was your family hungry in the last year, they will say no. If you ask them, did you have sufficient funds to meet all your essential needs, they will say yes, and by very, very large margins. Now, this is, I don't want to characterize this individual as being opulent or in any sense affluent. I think that these individuals that the government defines as poor have living standards that are dramatically different than your audience has in mind when they hear the word poverty. Now, that doesn't mean that within the so-called 30 million people that are poor, there isn't a small group that is closer to our conventional image of poverty, but it's a pretty small portion.
So where would you put, what percentage of the U.S. population, Robert Rector, would you say then is poor, if you're not going to go with the federal guideline, which says it's 12.5%?
I would say that if you're looking at people that have food shortages, have overcrowded housing, so or multiple problems like that, you're probably looking at 2% of the population. And also when you're looking at these individuals, you are almost in all cases looking at a lot of behavioral problems that go along with and contribute heavily to the material problems that they have. Mm-hmm. Now, there are a larger number of people that kind of skid along, have a hard time making ends meet. They don't make their monthly rent payments and things like that. But these are also individuals that have cable TV that they're paying for. So it's not that they're not struggling a bit, but they're struggling at a much higher standard of living than we conventionally think about as poverty.
Mark Greenberg?
Sure. It's important to sort this out. When we were talking about the federal poverty line, as you indicated in the beginning of the show, for a family of four, that's a little bit more than $19,000 a year. That translates for a family of four to $1,600 a month, roughly. So what the government is saying is under the official definition of poverty, if a family of four has less than $1,600 a month, they will be considered poor. The official definition of poverty is in many ways something that doesn't very effectively measure all of the costs of living in our society at this point. When we look at any measure of well-being, we see consistently that when we look at food measures, when we look at housing measures, when we look at medical measures, on every one of these, we see that the poor do worse than others, that the poor are more likely to be what's known as food insecure, to be concerned about where food is coming from, to be concerned about the ability to purchase balanced meals. The poor are more likely to be hungry than those who are not poor. When we look at medical care, the poor are more likely to have had time during the year where they needed to see a doctor and weren't able to do so, where they needed to see a dentist and weren't able to do so. When we look at things like, was your telephone disconnected in the last year? The poor are dramatically more likely to have faced a telephone being disconnected, more likely to have been evicted, more likely to have had utility shutoffs. On every measure that one would be concerned about of hardship, we consistently see that the poor have greater difficulty than others. Now,
hasn't that always been the case, though? That there is that expression
yes,
that the poor
yes,
shall
and,
always
and,
be with us. That if you have less money, you have a harder time.
And I do, I think it is absolutely right that if we look and compare to 40 years ago on issues of food, the poor are less likely to be malnourished or hungry now than they were 40 years ago. That is because of critical federal programs that have made a difference. The food stamp program, the school lunch program, the food for women, infants, and children, a federal initiative that has mattered enormously. When we look at health care, it is absolutely the case that the poor are in more likely to be able to receive access to health care now, and that is overwhelmingly because of the Medicaid and the Medicare programs. So federal programs have made a difference in addressing some of the most serious problems. At the same time, I would urge any members of your audience to think to themselves, if they were a family of four and what they had was $1,600 a month to meet their rent or mortgage, to pay for their food, to ask themselves, what situation would they be in after that?
Mm-hmm. Robert Rector, I'm going to give you a chance to respond, but we have to take a very quick break right now. We are talking this hour on the state of things about how you define poverty. This is kicking off a two-week series on poverty here at the State of Things. We welcome your calls. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. With us is Mark Greenberger, who is Director of Policy for the Center for Law and Social Policy, and Robert Rector, who is a Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Again, we're taking your calls, 1-877-962-9862. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. In the United States, you are considered poor if your family of four has an annual income of less than $19,350. That is the poverty level, the poverty line set by the U.S. government for this year. But is that level a true definition of poverty? As we kick off our two-week-long series, North Carolina Voices Understanding Poverty, we are today considering the question, exactly what is poverty? With us are Robert Rector, who is a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., and Mark Greenberg, who is director of policy for the Center for Law and Social Policy, also based in Washington. And we're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. Robert Rector, before the break, we had to say that we would get back to you after the break, so we're doing that now. We were talking about how much poverty may have changed since Lyndon Johnson launched the war on poverty four decades ago, and you wanted to respond to something that Mark Greenberg had said.
I can.
Okay, I'm sorry. I don't know if you heard the question I had just before the break.
I did not.
Okay, I'll pose it again. Just before the break, we were talking about how much the poverty in the country may have changed since Lyndon Johnson launched the war on poverty,
mm-hmm.
and you had a response to something that Mark Greenberg was talking about there.
Well, Mark listed a long set of deprivations, and it made a picture that sounded quite severe. But what he failed to tell you was that most poor people don't even come close to suffering from any of the problems that he talked about. For example, let's take a simple one, having your gas or electricity cut off due to non-payment. Well, that sounds pretty severe, but the reality is that that only happens to about 1% of U.S. households each year, and even among poor households, it only happens to about 3% of them. The overwhelming majority of poor households don't have those problems. He also talked a little bit about hunger, but he failed to tell us that 90% of poor households don't experience anything that could be called hunger, that the typical poor child, when they reach 18 or 19, are actually 1 inch taller and about 10 pounds heavier than the teenagers back at the time of Elvis, who were among the healthiest kids ever in U.S., in America, in world history. And the reality is that anybody who's familiar with this literature now, there's an increasing concern not only of obesity among American children, but this problem is most concentrated among poor children who are disproportionately not likely to be underweight and lacking food, but disproportionately likely to be obese. What we're to have here is a lot of flim-flam to create an impression of stark living conditions that really does not represent the 30 million people that are ostensibly poor, although you can find a much, much smaller population that has some of these problems as Mark's talking about. But it's a tiny fraction of the 30 million that are allegedly poor.
Okay, let's go to the phones now. Eric joins us from Henderson. Hi there, Eric.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I've got a question about medical dental, getting help for somebody that's on disability. You know, there's times when your dental problems can be so bad that that it causes you other problems. You have to see doctors, and doctors can't do anything for you. But Medicaid and Medicare doesn't help a person like that, you know, in any way whatsoever. Mm-hmm. You know, they can't afford to get dental treatment.
No,
I'm
are
just
you
wondering what your take is on that.
Well, are you speaking from personal experience?
Yes, I am. I'm speaking from very personal.
Uh-huh.
It's causing me, you know, a lot of pain and other physical problems that the docs can't help,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Well, before I ask our guest to answer that question, I want to pose the question to you that we're discussing this hour, which is, how do you define poverty?
Well, I don't define myself as being in poverty, even though I'm on disability and getting by on $12,000 a year, because I've got everything I own paid for, you know, and I've got air conditioning, I've got a car, but I can own the 20% that I'm paying on my regular medical bills is more than I can afford right now. And I can't afford to get anything done dental-wise, which is causing me most of my health problems.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to put that to Mark Greenberg first. Mark Greenberg?
Yeah, yeah. Sir, can I ask you, are you receiving Medicaid benefits right now? Are
yes,
you
sir,
eligible
I get
for
A
Medicaid
and B,
program?
But it covers uh-huh. about basically 80%.
Okay, is that through the Medicare program?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and are you able to receive Medicaid benefits in North Carolina?
I don't think so. I think I'm just okay. entitled to the basic where I pay $80 a month, you know, to take out of my check, and it just uh-huh. covers about 80% of your doctor's uh-huh. visits.
Okay, and you are receiving and you are receiving disability benefits?
Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
I'm almost 60 years old.
Okay, sir. What I would say is, if you're receiving disability benefits, you ought to check to find out if you might be eligible for Medicaid. And I don't know whether you will be or not in the state. I can say generally one of the real limits of Medicaid. Medicaid helps a lot of people, but much of the help is for children, sometimes for their parents, for the elderly and disabled. There are a group of adults who wind up getting left out and can't get any help from Medicaid. It's also the case that in a lot of places, the ability to get dental care through the Medicaid program is sometimes pretty limited. Just what's available and the willingness of dentists to participate in it is sometimes makes it hard to get help, but it's worth checking out, sir. And your situation, I'm very sorry about what you're facing. It really underscores, I think, as we're talking here, that you can't measure how somebody's doing by just asking whether they've got air conditioning.
Robert Rector?
Well, I mean, I certainly am not measuring just by whether they have air conditioning, and this is, in fact, one of the more prevalent problems you would see among the poor is difficulty obtaining dental care. I'm a little surprised that this individual can't get this emergency dental care done through Medicaid or Medicare. But again, that is one of the more common problems you would see, but only a very small minority of poor people suffer from that type of problem. And Mark is misrepresenting my viewpoint when he says I'm just looking at air conditioning. I think I'm looking at everything. I think this individual is a pretty good representative of someone who's poor or near poor and is having some problems. Most poor people don't have any problems at all. This one, it has some problems with dental care, but has a car, has air conditioning. I don't know whether he said whether he had cable TV or not, but you know, this is a much, much more affluent state of deprivation than we were talking about 40 years ago when Lyndon Johnson launched the war on poverty, or 50 years ago when close to a quarter of all U.S. households didn't even have indoor plumbing. Mm-hmm. And it's clearly representative of a rise in living standard. And as living standards go up for the poor and for the rich, the way that we redefine what it means to be in need also changes. And that's really the bottom line here.
We're talking this hour about how we define poverty. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's the number. Thanks for the call, Eric. Bob joins us now from Chapel Hill. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I just wanted to throw out another definition, and this one not original with me. It came out some years ago in an article in the New York Times. They were talking about poverty, not in terms of the federal numbers, because it obviously costs a lot more to live in New York or Boston or San Francisco or wherever than in rural North Carolina, or in terms of things, but in terms of discretionary dollars, that basically you are poor when you don't have enough money to meet the basic needs of life, you know, food, shelter, all that stuff, and you move into the middle class when you have a discretionary dollar that you can go out to eat on, go to McDonald's or whatever else. Likewise, you move into the upper class when you're making more money on your investments than you're making at whatever your job is.
Okay.
And to me, it serves as a real nice definition because it works wherever you might be in the country, despite cost of living or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
go ahead, Mark Greenberg.
Sure. One of the questions that comes up for all of us in how we want to define poverty or how we think our country should define it is what are we trying to measure? And certainly one thing to look at are questions like are you hungry? Are you able to avoid being evicted? So very basic needs. Another way of trying to get at it is to ask questions like, what does it take to get by in this community? What do you think a family needs to have a reasonably decent standard of living, to make ends meet? And the caller is right that number varies in different cities around the country. Pretty typically, when people are asked questions like that, you usually get a number that comes to about close to twice the federal poverty level. Often a number something in the range of $35,000 to $40,000 a year, sometimes more than that. And it is a recognition that over time our country is more wealthy. Our country does have greater resources available, and a critical part of thinking about poverty isn't just hunger and eviction. It is also thinking about what does it take to be able to be part of the social mainstream, that as our society becomes wealthier, what it means to be part of the mainstream changes too.
We should set a definition here as we're talking about defining poverty. We should point out that the federal poverty level, those numbers we've been batting about here this hour, right now one is considered to be living in poverty if in a family of four the income is less than $19,350 a year. This standard, which of course has gone up in the past 40 years, but it was set 40 years ago, and it was based on the idea that families spent a third of their income on food. And then this worker at the Social Security Administration, Molly Orshansky, she calculated three times that figure that people were spending on food as being what one needed to survive. And that's what we are basing it on to this day, even though 40 years later we're spending roughly a fifth of our income on food. But this gets to the issue of an absolute standard for poverty. Do you have the money to purchase those material things versus a relative standard? How do you stack up? How does your material wealth stack up against the rest of society? Robert Rector?
Well, I think that what we're seeing here is some sleight of hand in order to covertly redefine what we mean by poverty. If you ask the American public an open-ended question, what does the word poverty mean to you? The overwhelming majority respond in terms of dire deprivation, inadequate food and malnutrition, homelessness, not inadequate housing, but actually homelessness, but certainly dilapidated housing, lacking clothes for your family, and so forth and so on. That's what the emotional word poverty means. And we use the word poverty politically because it implies a moral imperative to assist people, and that's why it's used politically. But we just heard Mark basically kind of gloss over that. Well, you know, maybe there isn't actually any real material deprivation here in most cases, but we ought to think about a reasonably decent standard of living, part of the social mainstream. Well, this is a very different thing, and it's also a different thing if society is becoming more and more affluent, then your idea of what's a nice standard of living is going to go up over time. And I think if we were talking about the war to have a reasonably decent standard of living, people wouldn't get that excited about it. But we continue to use this word poverty, throwing out images that imply a stark, absolute condition of deprivation that's very, very rarely occurs in this society and hasn't occurred in it very much for a pretty long time. Also, all these games that we play with numbers and income, the simple fact of the matter is that the government does not measure the incomes of these lower-income people very well, and there's, in fact, a government task force looking into this right now. Also, most of the welfare assistance that we give to these individuals is not counted as income, so that they can be receiving lots and lots of assistance from the government and still be recorded as poor. Back when the war on poverty began, there was virtually no government assistance to provide a medical care for low-income people. Today, we spend over $250 billion on that. That implies, obviously, a significant improvement in standard of living, which is not at all captured in these federal poverty numbers. The same thing with public housing.
I have a question, though. Is the country better off for having fought that war on poverty beginning 40 years ago? Because those standards have come down.
It's a paradox, all right? The reality was that poverty was disappearing very rapidly in the 1950s and early 1960s prior to the war on poverty. And what the Johnson White House said was they predicted that it would disappear in the mid-1970s and said, we can really accelerate this. And I don't think that we accelerated it at all. I think we actually probably slowed up progress against poverty, particularly in certain groups. And the problem was that we spent an awful lot of money. We've spent over $9 trillion assisting low-income individuals since the beginning of the war on poverty. But we did it in such a way that we discouraged work and we discouraged marriage. And as the war on poverty unrolled, we saw a huge rise in the number of children that were born outside of wedlock from around 7% up to 33% today. We also saw a huge drop-off in the number of able-bodied working adults in low-income ranks who were working and an influx of those into the ranks of welfare. And so essentially we were kind of stepping on our own feet while we were trying to jump. And what we need to do, if we're really interested in moving these individuals forward, is to find a way that we don't pay people not to work and we don't pay people not to be married, but we harness their best energies and we supplement those energies rather than simply trying to replace them entirely, which is what the conventional welfare system did.
Mark Green, I want to give Mark Greenberg a chance to respond because I also want to get to another phone call soon. Mark?
Sure. Robert, you can't have it both ways. You can't simultaneously be talking about the improvements in health care or in food or in housing and not at the same time give credit to federal programs which have made a tremendous difference around food and health care and housing. In terms of it is absolutely right that we were showing significant progress in the 1950s and 60s. It started slowing in the 70s. That is the point that there was a profound change in the U.S. economy, where up in the post-war era, up until about 1973, we were seeing significant gains in real earnings for working men. We then saw a dramatic shift starting in the early 70s. Partly it was the oil shocks of that time. Partly it was a set of change in the economy that nobody understands very well. But the reality is that one of the big things that has happened is that over this period of time, people who haven't completed high school have seen declines in their real earnings. Over this period, we have seen enormous gulfs between the earnings of the college-educated and those who only complete high school. These are much broader changes in the economy that are affecting it, not that the war on poverty somehow stopped our gains in the fight against poverty.
I want to bring Russell in right now. Russell is calling from Chase City, just over the line in Virginia. Hi there, Russell.
Hello.
Hi.
I've had about 51 years experience in as a Protestant minister, most of the time working with very poor people. I'd like to ask, have there ever been any studies about consumerism, about advertising in relation to poverty? Because my experience has been that, when I go to the store to buy something, I spend part of my purchase price is advertising. And I've seen poor people put upon over the years in terms of advertising.
In other words, you mean suckered into buying something they didn't need, seeing all these riches laid out in advertising and also on TV?
Well, they've been suckered into buying things.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a poor a family I visited, and a Bible salesman showed up saying that your late husband who was killed, you know, had just ordered this $75 Bible. Well, you know, Gideons give you Bibles free. And that was just somebody trying to make $75 off of this family that they read about in an obituary.
Well, I'm going to have to hold off on getting an answer from our guests because we have to take a quick break. But thank you for your call, Russell. This is The State of Things. We are asking the question today, what is poverty? Our guests are Robert Rector, who is a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and Mark Greenberg, director of policy for the Center for Law and Social Policy. We are kicking off a two-week series looking at poverty in North Carolina. Just ahead, more of your calls at 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862 on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava, and today we're talking about poverty, what it is exactly, and how it may have changed since President Lyndon Johnson declared war on poverty 40 years ago. With us are Mark Greenberg, Director of Policy for the Center for Law and Social Policy in Washington, D.C., and Robert Rector, who is a Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, also in the nation's capital. We're taking your calls. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. I do want to get to a number of calls, but any comment on our last caller, the Protestant minister of 50 years who wondered about the poor being suckered into, my words, not his, into purchases or being taken advantage of through advertising or just consumerism.
I think
Robert Rector? Yeah.
I think one thing you do see is that they tend to change consumption patterns. There used to be a food consumption pattern, frugal food consumption that characterized even middle-class families in the 50s and 60s. That you really no longer see, even among the poor. We see a lot more prepared foods, a lot more eating at fast foods, a lot more meat consumption, for that matter. And that tends to put some strains on their budget. If I could just go back to one point, though, that Mark made. I'm not saying that the $9 trillion that we invested in the war on poverty didn't raise people's living standards. It obviously did. But at the same time, by discouraging work and marriage, which are the two principal causes of child poverty today, it essentially made that investment far less efficient, and it meant that we had a lot less progress than we could have had if the war on poverty had been more reasonably designed from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Mark Greenberg?
Sure. Yeah, let me respond directly to the caller.
Mm-hmm.
It is certainly the case that the poor, like all of us, sometimes fall victims of advertising. It's also the case that the poor sometimes fall victims of very unscrupulous individuals who take advantage of poor communities. There are significant problems around usurious loans, very high interest loans that people sometimes face, around various kinds of check cashing establishments that involve very, very high fees that individuals face. There are a set of studies that look at how even for basic necessities, the costs are often higher in low-income communities. Having said that, I do want to emphasize, though, that when we look at something like food, it's important to understand that the story is not that the poor are spending more on food or buying more than others. In fact, the exact opposite is the case. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has studied this. They have looked at spending per poor individual and compared it to spending for higher income individuals. And what they find is that the spending is substantially higher for those who are not poor. In their most recent study, the figure was $28 a week for poor individual, $43 a week for...
It sounds like we may have lost a connection there. We'll try to restore that. Let's go to the phones now. We are talking today about how you define poverty. We welcome your calls at 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. Sunny is with us from Rocky Mountain. Hi there, Sunny.
Hi.
Hi, welcome to the program.
My call. I think that you made a point earlier that kind of got skipped over, but I think is very important, and that's how true poverty is actually defined. Especially in terms of looking at it on the global perspective. And I think that both of your guests would agree that poverty doesn't exist in the United States like it exists in Africa, for instance, or Southeast Asia. And that's, when you say poverty, it brings to mind images of those kinds of people that have, you know, trouble staying alive day to day because they are malnourished, they have inadequate housing or no housing at all, they're subject to all kinds of diseases. And that's not the case in the United States with the poor here. And I think that we need to keep that in mind, that we don't, we end up supporting a lifestyle rather than supporting lives with the way that our welfare system is set up.
Mm-hmm. Robert Rector?
I think that's an excellent point. It's very, very well put. You know, the United Nations has an international poverty standard, which they define people as poor if they have an income of less than $1 per day. Well, virtually no one in the United States is poor by that standard. In fact, our poverty standard is about 20 times higher than that. And the reality is that almost all the people that we define as poor in the United States would be considered comparatively affluent in developing countries. Another typical piece of evidence of that is that the World Health Organization has a measure of child malnutrition, which is called stunting. It's shortness for your age, and it's due to a lack of nutritional intakes. Now, when you go into Asia or Africa, what you find is about 50% of the kids are defined as stunted or low relative to their age. They're short relative to their age. You look at the same thing among poor children in the United States, there's no stunting at all. In fact, as I indicated earlier, these kids are actually giants compared to middle-class kids from earlier generations. The typical poor American child today, a boy when he reaches 18 or 19, he's actually 1 inch taller and about 10 pounds heavier than the GIs that stormed the beaches of Normandy
right.
in World War II.
Well, Robert Rector, I wonder if there's a parallel between what you just said and something you mentioned earlier, and that is you were talking about the material things that those who fall below the poverty line in America right now have that perhaps the middle class may not have had 40 years earlier when the war on poverty started, but and, you know, the air conditioning, the multiple TVs in the house, the cars even. Mm-hmm. And you just mentioned that kids who are below the poverty line now are bigger than, say, the GIs that fought in World War II. But isn't that all, that's all considered progress, either amassing more material things, also perhaps getting, evolutionarily speaking, people getting bigger. And is that not progress? And are we talking here more about a relative sense of poverty or an absolute one? Which one do you prefer to make the reference?
I think that basically when you use a morally charged word like poverty, you're implying something fairly absolute, which is why I said basically what we are in a condition now of flim-flam, where we are trying to pretend that there are conditions of significant deprivation in the country that do occur, but they occur very rarely, and they don't occur to most poor people.
What word should we use then instead of the emotionally charged poverty?
Well, I think we're actually talking about low-income status. We're talking about a few material inadequacies. I mean, I'm very sympathetic with someone that gets their phone cut off. I mean, that's something to worry about, but that's very different than poverty in the third world. It's very different than poverty even in the 1950s. And I think we just need to be honest about that. We also need to look at that a lot of these poor families suffer from social and behavioral problems that are vastly more significant than any material problems. That there's crime, there's kids failing in school, there are emotional problems, there are drugs and things like that. And in particular, the collapse of the family, which I think has been promoted by the way that we gave this aid historically, which was focused on saying, here, you're a single mother, we're going to give you aid, and in fact rewarded these individuals for not being married, has in fact caused a huge social and behavioral deterioration at the same time that maybe material living standards were getting better. And so I think we really need to rethink. I think we need to put a lot less focus on just handing things out and start to focus more on encouraging constructive behavior, because if we can get the individuals that we're trying to help pulling in the same direction rather than simply relying on the government to give them more and more stuff. Again, I would come back to the fact that even if you just focus on material conditions, the two principal reasons that children are officially poor in the U.S. today are single parenthood, a lack of a father in the home, and then a lack of work. The typical poor family with children works only about 18 hours a week, even in the best economic times. And if you had more work in that family, if there was at least one adult working 40 hours a week, about 75% of those kids would immediately be lifted up out of poverty. So we have to restore the work ethic. We have to also begin to restore a marriage and bring fathers back in the home.
And I think we've restored our line to Mark Greenberg. Mark Greenberg, did you want to respond to that, to Robert Rector?
Yes, thanks. There is, I think, no question that poverty in the United States is different than it is in a third world nation. And frankly, I don't know of anybody who would suggest that they're the same. There's no question we're in a very, very different context. But when we talk about poverty here, it's fundamentally a question about what kind of a society do we want. And in particular, what kind of a society do we want for our children? It is absolutely the case that 40 or 50 years ago, fewer people had telephones or had indoor plumbing, and 150 years ago, nobody had telephones. But that doesn't help us think about what is it that we want for our society. Is it a good thing for children to be growing up in environments in which their families are struggling to make ends meet? And what kind of an impact does it have on their well-being and on their life chances? The research on this is very clear. It's clear that poor children are more likely to have emotional problems than other kids, more likely to have behavioral problems. They are less likely to complete high school. They're more likely to wind up having teen births. If you look at how they're doing when they become adults, they are less likely to be working. And if they are working, they're less likely to be earning less. So we are in important ways squandering key aspects of our nation's future by letting so many children grow up in conditions of poverty. And that's fundamentally what the discussion should be about.
And I think, Robert Rector, the case you make that is that there are so many children still in poverty because children don't work. And we're just describing and defining poverty by the amount of income that comes into a house. It's their parents that work. And you make the case that and a majority of those children who live in poverty are in households headed by a single mother.
Right, and I think that what Mark said is just fundamentally wrong, and it's that kind of thinking that really contributed to the problems of the war on poverty. The reality is that lack of income doesn't cause all of these behavioral problems that he's talking about. If it did, then everybody in the 1930s would have had these behavioral problems, and most of the people in the 1950s would have had them, and so forth and so on. It's simply silly when you look at it historically. The reality is... And I think the research is also pretty conclusive that adding on a little bit additional free handouts through welfare is not going to improve the well-being of these children very much. What we do need to do is actually look into the social conditions. I think that it's vastly more important than adding in some more free welfare benefits is the importance of getting a father back in the home. And I think that even most liberal research is now agreeing with that. And I think there's an agreement that the welfare system, to the extent it pushed fathers out of the homes over the last 40 years, has had a huge negative effect on kids and on our society. We need to rethink these things. We certainly don't need another round of saying, oh, you know, what we really need here is just, you know, to give everybody an extra $1,000 a year. That has not worked very well. It doesn't really meet the real needs. I think we need to look at why kids are failing in school directly. We need to look at why families aren't forming and staying together. I think those are the real problems that we have. And just adding on to the more free handouts in the welfare system isn't going to help those things at all.
Let's get to Beth.
Melinda, could I comment
briefly, because I want to get to Beth in Greenville before we go.
Sure.
Go ahead, Mark Greenville.
As Robert appreciates, I did not say a thing about free handouts. It is, in my view, crucial that we do more to both encourage work and to support people who are working. Part of the problem of poverty and low income among families is that our minimum wage has fallen far below its historic levels. Part of the problem is the large share of low-earning working adults who cannot earn enough to support a family. For single parents, we have seen a dramatic increase in employment over the last 10 years, but those families are often either still poor or very low income because of their earnings capabilities. So it is crucial to focus on helping people go to work and helping reduce the poverty of those who do.
And we could probably do a whole show on the minimum wage. We're not able to do that this hour, but I should point out minimum wage is $5.15 an hour. And the poverty guideline this year, $19,350 coming into a household for a family of four. If there were one person working there, that works out to $9.77 an hour. Let's go to Beth in Greenville. Hi there, Beth.
Hi, yes. Thank you for taking my call. My husband and I live in a neighborhood where most of our neighbors are lower income, and we're middle income. And I've noticed a few things that I wanted to point out. We know our neighbors very well. And the first thing I want to point out is that eating a healthy diet is very expensive for my neighbors. And it's a lot cheaper to buy overly processed foods, which I think accounts for part of the obesity that they suffer from. The second point I have is that my neighbors, none of them suffer from the social or behavioral problems that Mr. Rector has pointed out earlier. And the third thing that I wanted to point out is that credit card debt is something that has crippled my neighbors and has allowed them to live beyond their means. So I just wanted to maybe get some feedback on those three points.
Okay, you have about a half a minute, Robert Rector, and then Mark Greenberg.
Well, the simple fact of the matter is that nearly two out of three poor children in the United States live in single-parent families, and that's driven by the growth of out-of-wedlock childbearing and divorce. And I think those are problems we need to look at. I disagree very strongly that it's more expensive to eat a healthy diet than it is to eat processed fast foods. That's simply not true. In fact, healthy diets can be very cheap indeed. But I think most poor people don't really know how to go about setting up that type of diet.
Mm-hmm. And Mark Greenberg?
The caller is right about credit card debt, which has become an increasingly serious problem affecting both low-income and other families. The point that the caller makes about how people with very limited funds to spend for food may search for the foods which are most filling, which may not be the foods that are most nutritious, is a real concern.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank you both for joining us today to help us kick off our series on poverty in North Carolina. Thank you very much, Robert Rector and Mark Greenberg. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Robert Rechter is a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Mark Greenberger is director of policy for the Center for Law and Social Policy. And that is the state of things for today. You can learn more about our series, North Carolina Voices, Understanding Poverty, at our website, wunc.org. Support for North Carolina Voices, Understanding Poverty, comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University, Doug and Peggy Abrams, the Julian Price Family Foundation, Maupin Taylor, PA, and the Michael and Laura Broder-Arahe Foundation, and the North Carolina Humanities Council. Thank you, as always, for listening. If you have a comment about our program, our email is sot@wunc.org. I'm Melinda Pencava.